history for a reason. And if you're not a history buff, then please stay tuned, because I think by the end of this morning, you'll understand why we study history. And if you are a history buff, then you're in for a real treat, because this may be the most historic of all passages in all of the book of Daniel. Now, the prophecies that we see here in Daniel chapter 11, they are so incredibly precise that by the time we're done studying, it'll be clear to every believer that there is a sovereign God and that He both knows and determines all of the events that happen on the stage of world history. Now, you remember this chapter is part of Daniel's final vision. It begins in chapter 10 and verse 1. It goes all the way to the end of the book. The prophecy that's revealed here covers the time period from Daniel, about 536 BC, all the way to the end of the age and the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, let me give you the basic outline. You remember the final three chapters are broken up into two parts. The first part, chapter 10 and verse 1 to chapter 11 and verse 1, is simply the introduction to Daniel's vision. It kind of sets the context for the vision. Now, the second part of this final section here, chapter 11, verse 2, all the way to chapter 12 and verse 13, is the actual content of Daniel's vision. And we begin to consider that content last week. In verse 2, we studied the rise and the end of the Persian Empire. We then begin to look at the Grecian Empire, verse 3 to verse 35. You remember that begin in verses 3 and 4 with Alexander the Great. And then it went on with prophecies concerning two divisions of Alexander's kingdom, Egypt to the south and Syria to the north. And that was encompassed in verses 5 through 20. The entire section focused on the history of an ongoing conflict between two of the four kingdoms that broke off eventually from Alexander's empire. I'm going to show you that map again. You're familiar with it by now. To the south is Egypt. That is known as the Ptolemy Empire. To the green area, the orange to the south, the green is Syria and all points east, and that is known as the Seleucid Empire. So we would read the kings of the south, Egypt, the kings of the north, Syria. Now, we might ask the question, why does the Bible focus, because you remember there's four divisions of Alexander's kingdom, why does the Bible focus on these two dynasties in particular? Well, I think the answer is obvious when you look at a map, because right where the green and the orange meet together is the tiny strip of land that we call Israel. So for about 150 years, as the Ptolemies to the south and the Seleucids to the north fought for control of the Middle East, they often fought on the very plains of the land of Israel. Now, the history of Egypt and Syria is divided for us here into two separate parts. First of all, for the first 100 and so many years, there was Egypt's dominance of Syria, and that's verses 5 through 12. The second part then becomes Syria's dominance of Egypt, and that's verse 13 through 20. And let me just remind you again, I've added a few names here, but just the kings who reigned during that time period, and we looked at most all of those last time. So I'm not going to go back over that, from which you'll be thankful. There's a lot of precise history there, but I just want to remind you of how it ends. So look at chapter 11 and verse 20. Then, in Antiochus the Third's place, Antiochus the Great, one will arise, Seleucus the Fourth, who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. So the king described there is Seleucus the Fourth. You remember, he only reigned for a brief time. He was shattered. He was killed. Though he wasn't killed in anger like his father Antiochus the Third, nor was he killed in battle. Instead, he was poisoned by his prime minister, a man named Heliodorus. He was the prime minister and tax collector in Syria. And you remember, he poisoned Seleucus IV in an effort to gain the throne. Now listen, this is important here. Because Heliodorus had an accomplice when he poisoned Seleucus IV, who was the king of Syria. And his accomplice was one of the most notorious men in all of the history of Israel. And we are going to meet that man this morning. In fact, all the history that we've been studying now for the past couple of weeks all simply sets the furniture on the stage for this man to now enter the scene. His name is Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and he's described for us in verses 21 through 35. Now, you may remember we met this guy before. He is the little horn in chapter 8 of Daniel. He became the king of Syria in 175 BC. He ruled really for 12 brief years until 163 BC. But the devastation he brought in the land of Israel during those years is hard to imagine. It's a great reminder, by the way. And I want you to think through all of this as it relates to our day. It's a great reminder of how quickly politics can change and how quickly life as we know it can change as well. Now, what's interesting about this is the space that the angel, you remember he's revealing this vision to Daniel, the space that he gives this man. Because verses 2 through 20, they cover about 355 years. But verses 21 through 35, a relative similar amount of space, they cover only 12 years. So evidently, this man, Antiochus IV, he is very important to God and he's very important to the angel who's revealing the vision to Daniel. Which begs the question, why? Why does Antiochus merit so much space in Daniel's prophecy? Not only here, but back in chapter 8 as well. Well, I would tell you there's at least two reasons. Number one, because he plays a major role in the history of the people of God. The time of the rule of Antiochus is one of the darkest times in all of Israel's history, or the Jewish people's history, maybe rivaled only by the time of the previous century to us of what the Germans did. So the people of God needed to know so that they could be prepared. Also, they needed to know so that they would remember that God had told them this. So when these dark days come, they're reminded that God is on the throne, that He is in charge, that He had warned them this was coming and there would be an end to it. So that's the first reason that the angel tells Daniel about this man. The second reason that so much space is given to this guy is because he becomes a living illustration of the future Antichrist. You may remember in chapter 8, he is the little horn that precedes the coming Antichrist. He is going to picture what kind of person the Antichrist is going to be. He did that in chapter 8. He's going to do it again here in chapter 11. So in essence, we would say that this chapter we're about to go through, or this next paragraph, it's going to teach us a lot about the Antichrist who will come at the end of the age. That's why these two guys are always linked together. Because if you want to know who the Antichrist is going to be, then simply study Antiochus IV. He is an illustration, if I could put it that way, of who the Antichrist will be. So let's go ahead and kind of jump into our text here. I've got a number of outline points if you're keeping track. Number one, we see Antiochus' despicable character. And that's in verse 21, his despicable character. In Seleucus IV's place, a despicable person will arise. Despicable, worthy of being despised. Dale Ralph Davis calls this profoundly evil man a slick and godless piece of scum. Now, he really is. We are going to find him to be a schemer, a deceiver. a habitual liar. Listen, he is a politician. He is utterly ruthless. He is responsible for countless acts of torture, for tens of thousands of deaths. He is extremely arrogant, and the self-perception he has of himself greatly exceeds any good that he ever brought to his people that he ruled. In fact, after Antiochus gained the throne, he gives himself an official name, and the name he gives himself before his people is Antiochus Theophilus Epiphanes, Antiochus, God revealed. That's the title he took for himself. He was referring to himself as the greatest of all Greek gods, Zeus Olympus. He even put that title, by the way, on the coins that he minted. So on our little coins, it says, "In God we trust." On the coins of Syria, Antiochus, God revealed. Now, of course, his enemies didn't buy it. And they did sort of a play on names. So his name was Antiochus Epiphanes, but they called him Antiochus Pimames. It sounded the same, but it was a different meaning. Antiochus the madman, which you'll see was far more accurate. Now this man is so amazingly arrogant. Just look for a moment back at chapter 8. Here's what he thought of himself. Chapter 8 and verse 11. It, the little horn, Antiochus, even magnified himself to be equal with the commander of hosts. You could turn back. That is God himself. In other words, Antiochus actually considers himself God's equal. And he sets himself in opposition against the people of God. Excuse me. He attacks the people of God. He becomes one of the most dangerous opponents of the worship of Yahweh in all of the history of Israel. Truly, he is a despicable man. That brings us to our second point. We learn about his manipulative beginnings, verse 21. In Seleucus the fourth place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been properly and rightly conferred. So he was not in line to take the throne in Syria after his oldest brother, Seleucus IV's death. The throne rightly belonged to Seleucus IV's son, Demetrius I. He was the nephew of Antiochus IV. So when Seleucus IV died, conveniently, Demetrius I is being held captive in Rome. Now that provides the kind of the in for Antiochus. The end of verse 21, but he will come in a time of tranquility and he will seize the kingdom by intrigue. After Heliodorus poisons Antiochus' older brother Seleucus IV, he and those, Antiochus being one of them, who conspired with them, they take the throne. Heliodorus is planning to be the next king, and there's a time of tranquility as they're setting up this new government empire. But at that moment, Antiochus steps forward. He takes the throne by intrigue, you would say by slippery actions, by deceptive actions. We're talking politics here. He steps forward publicly and he says something along this line. Listen, it's my nephew who's in prison in Rome. He's really the one to whom this throne belongs, but he can't be here. But we need to make sure we keep the throne in the family. Someone in the family needs to step into the role. So I'll be his co-regent until he's released from Rome and comes back here. In fact, I'll be co-regent with his brother, another son of Seleucus IV. He's only an infant at this time. They wouldn't make him the king. I'll be co-regent with him until either my cousin gets released or my nephew gets released from Rome or my other nephew grows up, who, by the way, mysteriously is murdered in the next couple of years. So that's how by intrigue he takes over. He uses his nephew's absence to deceive the influential people in Syria that someone from the family needs to stay on the throne. So that's his deceptive beginning. Which brings us, number three, to the angel who introduces us to his hostile reign. Verses 22 through 28b really is the heart of this passage. the year is 175 BC. He schemes his way to power. He's now the king of Syria. 5 years later in 170 BC, he's going to begin the persecution of the Jews by assassinating the rightful high priest in Israel and replacing him with his own puppet Jewish high priest who will be loyal to him. Then a year later, 169 BC, Ptolemy VI comes from Egypt. You remember it was the Ptolemy dynasty that actually lost the land of Israel to Antiochus III, the father of our Antiochus, and now the Egyptians want to take it back. So Ptolemy VI comes up and he attacks Antiochus in order to gain the land of Israel. In response, Antiochus gathers his army. There is a counterattack, and this begins, remember this, the first Egyptian campaign. Now that's described for us, verse 22. The overflowing forces, that is the overwhelming army of Ptolemy VI from Egypt, they will be flooded away. They'll be swept away like a flood before Ptolemy VI and shattered. And also, and this is a reference to Ptolemy VI, he will become the prince of the covenant. So, the Egyptian army is defeated by the Syrians. They are run back to Egypt. But Ptolemy VI is captured by Antiochus Epiphanes. He is held prisoner. He becomes then the prisoner of the treaty. In other words, Ptolemy VI wants to be free from prison and get back on the throne of Egypt. Antiochus IV wants greater control over Egypt. He begins a conversation with his prisoner. If I can get you back on the throne in Egypt, which is now taken over by the brother of Ptolemy VI, Ptolemy VII, if I can get you back on the throne, that will put you in the position you want to be, but it'll give me greater power over Egypt as well. So that becomes the plan. He becomes the prince or the king of this covenant he will make with Antiochus IV. Of course, both are happy to go along with it because they're going to get what they want. Verse 23, after this alliance is made with Antiochus and Ptolemy VI, he will practice deception. He will go up and he will gain power with a small force of people. So with the help of Antiochus IV, Ptolemy IV, the sixth, regains his throne, but later Antiochus is going to double-cross him. Look at verse 24. In a time of tranquility, now Egypt is feeling a bit secure. Antiochus then comes with his army once he installs Ptolemy VI. They enter the richest parts of the realm of Egypt. They accomplish, as I'm just reading through this, what Antiochus' fathers never were able to do. They plunder Egypt. They distribute the plunder and riches and possessions among the people of Antiochus. By the way, this is a common tactic of all underhanded politicians. They use money, they use riches, they use wealth to bribe others in power to gain their loyalty. So Antiochus gains the spoils of war from Egypt. He passes them out to his followers, to other leaders, in order to gain their support. Verse 24, he will enter into the richest parts of the realm of Egypt. He will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He'll distribute plunder, beauty, possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds. He has grand plans to conquer all of Egypt, not just the eastern part of it. But notice the end of verse 24, but this is only going to last for a time. His success will be brief. It'll be limited. It'll only be for the time that God decreed. Now, what we're going to find in the next group of verses, verse 25 through 28, is the angel kind of goes back and he's going to rehash all of this first Egyptian campaign by Antiochus, and he's going to kind of fill us in with the backstory of more details. So look at verse 25. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. And so the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for the schemes will be devised against him. So even though Ptolemy came into the battle with a larger army, this is the initial battle when Ptolemy VI tries to conquer Antiochus. He's unable to stand against Antiochus' army. Why? Because schemes were devised against him. What were these schemes? Look at verse 26. It was from those who ate at Ptolemy VI's own choice food. They will destroy him. His army will overflow, but many will fall and down slain. So who are those who observe food at the king's table? They were his greatest wise men. They were his greatest trusted advisors. And what happens in Egypt and what happens to many leaders is they get a bunch of, quote, know-it-all underlings who are advising the king, and they advise him to go up and take the land of Israel, which was taken from his father, and you could defeat Antiochus IV, and we'll get the land back. And he assembles an army, and he goes, and he ends up getting defeated and taken captive. All that invited the counterattack by Antiochus, verse 27. And now for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will begin to speak lies to each other at the same table. So once Antiochus defeats and captures Ptolemy VI, Ptolemy VII becomes king of Egypt. Antiochus wants control of Egypt, as I said. He begins to discuss with Ptolemy VI how they could take Egypt back together. I'll put you back on the throne, but I'll have some power over you. So they both pretend, think United Nations here, they both pretend to befriend each other. They conspire together how Ptolemy VI could get back to Egypt. Both these men are evil. They're each telling each other lies to get what they want out of the agreement they're going to make. The fact is, this statement in verse 27 is a perfect description of international diplomacy. Look at the end of verse 27. But it will not succeed. In other words, they plan that they concoct won't succeed. There's going to be a little bit of success, I'll tell you about it, but only slightly successful. So Antiochus IV takes Ptolemy VI and Antiochus' army back to Egypt, and they conquer the eastern part of Egypt all the way to the city of Memphis, which was kind of a strategic center in Egypt. They install Ptolemy VI as the king of eastern Egypt, but his brother Ptolemy VII still controls western Egypt, the great city of Alexandria. When Antiochus could make no more progress with his army in Egypt, he returns back to the land of Syria. And by the way, when he returns, guess what happens? The two brothers, the sixth and the seventh, get back together. They form a truce. They join forces together. They make Egypt again one great empire. So in the end, Antiochus' purposes are frustrated. Why? Well, the end of verse 27, for the end is still to come at an appointed time. One commentator wrote this: in spite of all the plans made by human leaders, God is still sovereign, and the end of this evil king Antiochus and his enterprises would come only at God's appointed time. So its success is only because of the plan of God, and ultimately his failure also comes about only because of the plan of God. Verse 28. So Antiochus IV will return from Egypt to his land with much riches, the riches he took plundering Egypt, but on his way back, he is angry that he didn't take all of Egypt. So his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. That is against the Jews who have made. He must take his frustrations out on somebody because he couldn't conquer Egypt. And he will take action, verse 28, and then he will return to his own land. Now take note of this. Antiochus, this is all of his first Egyptian campaign. And all of that becomes the backdrop for our verse here. He conquered half of Egypt. He installed Ptolemy VI. Ptolemy VI then turns his back on him. He got to plunder Egypt, but not all of Egypt. And now he's returning back to Syria. He is frustrated. He is angry. And he's going to go to that little land bridge of Israel to get back to Syria. And as he does, he passes through the city of Jerusalem. Now, let me tell you what the rumor was going on in Jerusalem as he passes through. There was no internet back then, not that that prevents lies. No cable news, not that that prevents lies. But when he passes through the city of Jerusalem, he wrongly hears that the Jews believe that he was killed in battle in Egypt. And when they believe he's killed in battle, they replace his puppet high priest in Israel, they replace his puppet government with Israel, and they put their conservative Jews, the Old Testament Jews, back in charge. When he comes to Jerusalem and he sees what happens, he is viciously angry. And in response, he throws out that puppet government and he replaces it with his own. And now he's got to stamp out the rebellion. He murders many of the Jewish leaders. He plunders the temple. Listen to 2 Maccabees chapter 5 here, kind of a historical account. Raging inwardly, he left Egypt and took the city of Jerusalem by storm. He commanded his soldiers to hunt down relentlessly everyone they met and kill those who went into their houses. They begin to massacre young and old, destruction of boys and women and children, as well as the slaughter of young girls and infants. Within just 3 days, they slaughtered 80,000 Jews, and as many they took in slavery back to Syria, unquote. This is the man Antiochus. And then with the help of his evil puppet high priest that he reinstalled in Israel, he loots the temple and he takes the treasures of the temple of God back to Syria. Now, all of that brings us to our fourth point. And that's his devilish plans. Verses 29 through 32. Let me start in verse 29. At the appointed time, he will return and come back to the south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. Now, this introduces us to the second Egyptian campaign. He is furious that the brothers have tricked him, that they're back in power, that he has no power over Egypt. So the year is 168 BC, and notice we see this throughout the passage. Everything is at the appointed time, the appointed time, the appointed time. That's not Antiochus' appointed time, that's God's appointed time. So the second campaign is not successful like the first one. So the question we might ask is, why? Well, look at verse 30, I love this. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Now, Kittim's an old word. It describes all the various islands that you might see and you can't see in the Mediterranean Sea, but it also describes the entire north shore of the Mediterranean Sea all the way to Italy. Now, that's what's going on here. You remember I told you last week, Rome is the growing boy on the block, and he is getting stronger by the moment. On his second campaign, he is met by the fleet of the Roman army. They were sent to Egypt at the request of Ptolemy, who's afraid Antiochus is going to come back and conquer Egypt. Now, there's several historic documents at this point that explain to us what happened, and I want to give you some of this. I've shared this with you a little bit before. But as the Syrians are moving to besiege the city of Alexandria, the Roman general Linnaeus confronts Antiochus about 4 miles outside east of the city of Alexandria. And Linnaeus gives Antiochus a letter from the Roman Senate. And the letter reads like this. Antiochus, if you stay here in Egypt, just know, you're going to be at war with Rome. So your only option if you want to avoid war with Rome is to go back to Syria. Well, in typical fashion, Antiochus in his pride has to think about it. I've got to consult with my consulars. And of course, history records this so wonderfully. So General Linnaeus responds, I understand completely. I'm a leader as well. I would have to consult with my consulars. So Antiochus, you take all the time that you need to consult with your consulars. And at that moment, Linnaeus pulled out his sword and he drew a circle around Antiochus and he said this, just don't leave this circle until you give me a decision. Now, you remember from last week, Antiochus was already aware of Rome's power. They had defeated his father, Antiochus III, in the Battle of Magnesia in Turkey. And now he was finally starting to understand that he was never going to be able to expand his kingdom towards the west because of the power that Rome had gained. So he has no other option but to retreat. Verse 30, for the ships of Kittim come against him, therefore he will be disheartened. And he'll return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he'll come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So here's Antiochus. Put yourself in his sandals. He's come face to face with Rome. He realizes that he's expanding his kingdom is going to be impossible. So what's he going to do? He is going to consolidate power in the kingdom that he has with the rule that he has. And he's going to vent his anger by taking action against the Jewish people who remain faithful to their God. So to accomplish this, he's going to befriend and make allies with those Jews who had forsaken the covenant of their God. In other words, these are apostate Jews. They are unbelieving Jews. Verse 31, forces from him will arise. They will desecrate the sanctuary, the temple fortress, and they'll do away with the regular sacrifice. So after his humiliation in Egypt, in 167 BC, Antiochus sends his chief tax collector, a man named Apollonius, to Jerusalem. Now, initially, Apollonius comes offering peace to Israel. He comes to Jerusalem. He acts like it's a mission of peace. But then on the Sabbath day, the day the Jews were most unlikely to fight and most unlikely to run, he attacks them. The result is an ugly, bloody massacre. There is massive looting. There is rampant destruction of the temple in the city. Listen to 1 Maccabees chapter 1. The king sent to the cities of Judah a chief collector of tribute. And he came to Jerusalem with a large force of more than 20,000 soldiers. Deceitfully, he spoke peaceably words to them, and they believed him. But suddenly, he fell upon the city. He dealt it a severe blow. He destroyed many people of Israel. He plundered a city, burned it with fire. He tore down its houses and surrounding walls. He took captive women and children. He seized their livestock. Now Antiochus follows this massacre with an attempt at Hellenization of the land of Israel. Now we've talked about that word before. The idea is to make all things Greek. You see, before Antiochus took the throne in Syria, he had lived in Athens for years. Athens was the center of all Grecian culture. He became enamored with Grecian culture. It was looked upon as the highest culture of the day, the more sophisticated culture of the day. Certainly, it was the most immoral, debauched, perverted culture of the day. And now he has one agenda. He is going to force Hellenization on the Jewish people. And if they resist this, he is going to persecute to the point of death. So in 167 BC, he issues an order that all temple worship of the living God is to stop. All of the regular sacrifices is to come to an end. There could be no more worship of Yahweh in his empire. It goes on in verse 31, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. What is this? The abomination of desolation. In 167 BC, December, Antiochus has his troops erect an idol of the Greek god Zeus Olympus on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. 1 Maccabees 154, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering that left the temple in an abomination that left it desolate, completely unable to be used for the worship of the true and living God. 10 days later, it got worse. They made a series of sacrifices, mostly unclean pigs. They killed hundreds of pigs all over the temple in Jerusalem. They took the insides of the pigs. They smeared them on the walls. They poured them on all of the sacred furniture. They completely desecrated the temple with uncleanliness. 2 Maccabees chapter 6, he caused them to pollute the temple in Jerusalem and to call it the temple of Olympian Zeus. Harsh and utterly grievous was the onslaught of evil for the temple, for the temple was filled with debauchery. I'm not even going to read all this to you. Reveling by the Gentiles, who dallied with prostitutes, with all kind of perversion within the sacred precincts. And besides this, they brought things in for sacrifice that were unfit. So the altar now, the sacred altar, is covered with abominable offerings. All of that which is forbidden by Jewish law. People were unable to keep the Sabbath every week. They were unable to observe any of the great Jewish festivals of their ancestors. The temple itself became a temple for pagan deities, and all kinds of perversions were going on night and day in the temple, the Father's house, as Jesus says. Now, let me tell you how far it went. There's one other note to learn about this man. I'll just read it to you for time. In chapter 8 and verse 12, it says, he will fling truth to the ground. Antiochus is going to prohibit the teaching of the Word of God in his empire. He is going to completely try to eradicate any reminder of the living God from his empire. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, the books of the law that were found, they tore them in pieces, they burned them with fire. Anyone found possessing the book of the covenant or anyone adhered to the law was condemned to death by the decree of the king. So as you could imagine, these were dark days in Israel's history. Verse 32, by smooth words, he's a politician. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. Sadly, by flattery, by bribery, he convinces many of the apostate Jews, many of the priests especially, who eventually, by the way, become the Sadducees. And when we get to the Gospels, he convinces many of them by bribery to support his policies. They could become rich by becoming progressive. He, even his puppet high priest, Millenius, he becomes a leader in convincing the other priest. Now we'd ask the question, what was Antiochus trying to accomplish here? Well, he was trying to completely purge the Jewish culture of everything Jewish. He was trying to replace it with everything Greek. He's trying to eradicate the worship of God. He desired a perverse, debauched society. He desired a wicked society where people would worship the pantheon of the Greek gods. And it was Yahweh God that was the conscience of a society like that. So he sought to purge society from Yahweh. Now, thank God not everyone went along with it. And that's our fifth point, verse 32 through 34. We meet his determined foes. Look at verse 32. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. So those are the traitors. But the people who know their God, they will display strength and they will take action. How do they do that? Well, they do it particularly in two different ways. Some do it by becoming martyrs. 1 Maccabees 1:62, many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than be defiled by food or profane the holy covenant. And listen, many did die. The second way they resisted is others chose to fight. Now, it was out of this horrific time in history, and you're familiar with this, that the Maccabean revolt was born. And the fuse that was used to light the Maccabean revolt, it was in the most unlikely of places. It was a little Jewish town of Modin, about 20 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Let me give you the story. Antiochus sent soldiers, captains, lieutenants, and generals to villages all around Israel. So there was one particular general named Apelles. He came with a small group of soldiers to the little village of Modin. And he took the leading priest of that city and he demanded that priest sacrifice a pig on the altar in order to worship and show loyalty to Antiochus. That leading priest refused to do it. His name was Mattathias. The general looked and he chose another Jewish man, one of less courage, and he demanded, offer that pig on the altar or you're going to die. That Jewish man offered the pig on the altar. When he had finished, Mattathias and his five sons were so enraged, Mattathias pulled out his sword and he thrust it into the torso of that traitor Jewish priest who offered the sacrifice. His sons then killed the general Apelles and the small group of soldiers that were with them. And Mattathias gathered the whole village together and basically said this, anyone who loves the true God, leave the village, come with me to the hills, we are going to fight against this. He and his five sons and an initial group from that town, they formed a small army. And for months, they fought a guerrilla warfare against a much stronger Syrian force. But the more victories they gained, the more they begin to grow, and more faithful Jews joined them. Now, after about a year of fighting this guerrilla war, Mattathias becomes severely ill. He can't go on. So he appoints his son, his eldest son, Judas Maccabeus, translated Judas the Hammer, to be in charge. Judas Maccabeus was a very, very capable soldier and general. And it's under his leadership 3 years later that the Jews recapture the city of Jerusalem and the temple. Basically, 3 years after Antiochus sets up the idol of the Olympian god Zeus, Judas removes everything pagan from the temple. He has it rebuilt according to the law of Moses. And on the 25th day of the month Kislev, by the way, December on our Julian calendar, the Jews for the first time order back the worship of Yahweh. The celebration lasts for 8 days. There's singing, there's feasting, there's sacrifices. The Jews agree that this is such a significant event in their history that they perpetually make it a feast, the festival of lights, which today we call Hanukkah. Now, verse 33 summarizes the fate of true believers during those dark days. Beloved, listen, these are brothers and sisters under the Old Testament covenant. Verse 33, those who have insight, I would say into Daniel's prophecy, among the people will give understanding to many. In other words, the Jews will wonder what's going on. Those who understand these prophecies of Daniel will share with them the truth. God had prophesied this. And yet they will fall by the sword and by the flame and by captivity and plunder for many days. During this time period, tens of thousands of believing Jews are going to be killed in the bloody reign of Antiochus. Some are going to fall by the sword in their fight with the Maccabees against the soldiers of Antiochus. Others are going to be taken captive. They're going to be burned, literally burned with a flame at the stake. I mean, if you want to read a story of just how bad it is, find a copy of 2 Maccabees and read chapter 7. It tells the story of a mother and her 7 sons. They were captured by one of Antiochus's small group of soldiers. They were said, if you would denounce Yahweh as God, and if you would worship Antiochus, nothing will happen to you. They all refused. The soldiers started by ripping off the scalps of the sons in front of the mother. And then they began to cut off their hands and they cut off their feet. And still the boys would not recant. And then they burned a pot of oil, and one by one, and before their mother's eyes, they threw each boy in the pot, and they boiled them to death, and at the end of the day, they threw the mother in. And they were all killed. By the way, many believe that her story is alluded to where? Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 35, women received their dead raised to life again. They had their property confiscated. Those that weren't killed were taken into slavery. And verse 33 says this will happen for many days. And many days meaning several years of horror. Verse 34, now when they fall, they will be granted a little help. Probably, I'm guessing, referring to the help of the Maccabeans who are going to try to turn the tide, and they will for a while. Look at the end of verse 34. I just hate this. And many will join Antiochus and his men, or many will join the Maccabees in their hypocrisy. Here's the idea. The Maccabean revolt started very small. So many of the Jews, the progressive Jews, they lined themselves up with Antiochus to save their skin. But as the Maccabean revolt got bigger and bigger, and as they begin to turn the tide, at least for a while, when the tea leaves were being written and it looked like the Maccabees might win, many of these progressive Jews turned away and they turned back and they joined the Maccabean revolt, lest they maybe lose their lives from the conservative Jewish end. So they were hypocrites pretending to believe in Yahweh when they really didn't. In other words, phony believers going it whichever way the wind blew. All right, that brings us to our last point, number 6. We see the Lord's plan in all of this, verse 35. The Lord's plan. Some of those who have insight, believers, will fall. Many true believers are horribly persecuted. They are killed. I want you to get this next phrase. Why in the world would God ever allow this? Where is God? Verse 35, in order. They will fall for this reason, to refine, to purge, and to make them pure. I would say that God has a higher purpose in life than we do, right? God intended Antiochus' terrible sin against his people to refine his people. They weren't living for God as a nation. To purify his people, to strengthen their faith, to cleanse them of all of their sinful practices. And I find the word purge very interesting. It means to distinguish or to separate, we would say, the unregenerate from true believers in the nation, which is exactly what's going to happen. Those who were the real thing, it became evident and obvious when Antiochus came with his army. And those who weren't, that also became evident. The end of verse 35, until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. Until the end time. I think it's hard to know exactly what the angel means here. I think obviously he refers to the end of Antiochus' reign of terror. You remember that is a specific time. We saw it back in chapter 8. It would be 2,300 days and nights, or I think it was morning and nights. In other words, for 2,300 days on the Jewish calendar, 6 years and 4 months, Antiochus would launch his reign of terror against the Jewish people. And finally, in 163 BC, after 12 years of reigning, 6 years and 4 months of persecuting terror, Antiochus dies a horrible death. We've talked about that before. And he ends his reign of terror. But I think the expression at the end of verse 35 here, I think it goes beyond the end of Antiochus' reign of terror. I think the angel is looking further down the road, and there's some grammatical evidence for this. I think the angel is saying this, that this pattern of God using persecution and suffering of his people to refine them, to purify them, to cleanse them, this pattern will continue to the end of history. How interesting is that, right? That would include persecution that comes under the Antichrist. That's the grammatical tie, which is the very next paragraph. So what is the point? The point is the duration of evil rulers and their persecution of God's people is all under the control of our great God, and he allows it to happen for our good and for his glory, and he already knows when it's going to end because he determined it. All right, well, listen, all that brings us to the question of why, right? Here we go again. Why all of this history, Pastor? Why do we have to rehearse all of this? Is there any lessons here for us? I'm going to give you a few powerful ones, all right? So stick with me. Number one, God is sovereign over the smallest details of history. Now listen, just step back for a moment. Maybe you're tempted to ask this, Pastor, why all of this history? What's the point of all of this history? Listen, if that's your question, then you've completely missed the point. How do you say that? Because remember, none of this is history from Daniel's perspective. It's all prophecy. It's all given to Daniel 400 years before it ever happens as prophecy. This chapter is not a history of Antiochus Epiphanes. It's an incredibly accurate prophecy fulfilled down to the smallest detail. The lesson is God is still writing the details of history right up until this day. Listen, who knows what's going to be in the headlines tomorrow? Well, God does. That's the answer. And don't for a moment imagine he's any less involved in what the headlines are tomorrow than he was back in Daniel's day and Antiochus' day. God has a generational plan, and he is working out that plan now as he did back then. So if you're worried about what's going on in our world, and if you're worried about what's going on in our nation, just think about the comfort the prophecy of Daniel provided to the believers who lived during the day of Antiochus. Yes, the land was filled with terror, but they knew without a doubt that God was in control in what he was trying to accomplish. And then one day it would come to an end upon their death or Antiochus. Del Ruff Davis writes this, even chaotic time is appointed time. I love it. Daniel, you remember in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's having a dream. The dream is about his empire collapsing. He's all worried about losing his empire. And he brings Daniel into the palace throne room. And Daniel comes in, Daniel chapter 2 and verse 28, and says, O king, there's a God in heaven. There's somebody who's in control here. It's not you either. Number two, Jesus Christ is ruler over all the kings of history. That's Revelation 1:5. Jesus Christ, the ruler over the kings of the earth. If you forget everything else I said, just remember Revelation 1:5. Jesus Christ is ruler over all the kings of the earth. And one day he's going to crush them all, by the way. All right, let me move on. Number three, I want you to get this one. Even the most powerful rulers and kings are temporary. Remember, Alexander ruled for only 12 years. It seemed like forever. I get it. It seemed like his devastating reign would just go on forever and ever. Listen to how Isaiah put it, chapter 40, verse 23. It is he who reduces rulers to nothing. It is he who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them and they wither and the storm carries them away like stubble. Christian, your God's on the throne. Don't forget that. Number four, get this. God uses the suffering and persecution of his people to accomplish his good purposes in their lives, to refine them, to purify them, to strengthen the faith of believers, to cleanse the church of its sinful practices. And I really think the one point there, the word purge, is very interesting. That is to distinguish and separate the unbelievers from true believers. You know, I've been around over 30 years now pastoring. I've seen so many controversies come and go, so many things sweep through the church, all kinds of stuff. And listen, right now we are going through that again as the church always seems to be going through it. And you say, why is that? Why is this stuff always happening? How about 1 Corinthians 11:19? Paul says, for there also must be factions among you. In other words, things that divide. Why? So that those who are approved by God may be evident among you. In other words, God brings difficult times into the life of his people so that the false and the true could be distinguished from one another, just as he did during the time of Antichrist. You watch, given enough time, whatever, you know, the latest thing that is sweeping across the evangelical church, given a couple of months or a couple years, it's going to become clear. Those who clung to God, those who clung to his word, those who clung to the true gospel. It's God's way of sorting things out. Persecution, every wind of doctrine. Number five, finally, the day's coming. The day's coming. When a man like Antiochus will again rise to power. But this time he's not going to just rule Syria. He's going to rule the entire planet. And Lord willing, next week we'll meet him. All right, let's bow for prayer. Father,